Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These countries cannot be ignorant because they don't see what the impacts in our lives are. They cannot just go for a treaty that's unambitious and that's not legally binding, because that means they will basically do nothing.
We believe that we should have an open and transparent discussion of these issues. This is not something to be discussed in a small room amongst a few people.
There's a gap between the developed and the developing world on this issue, which could actually wreck the conference.
Representatives to the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference. We heard Ashwini Prabha, an environmental activist from Fiji, Ian Fry, delegate from Tuvalu, and George Soros, the American billionaire and financier, in a news conference. The EU, by the way, also has a new proposal, as does George Soros, for developed countries to subsidize developing ones for anti-carbon work. We just heard from NPR News that the EU and the French President Sarkozy think this could be a breakthrough. We'll find out if that's true. A dozen or more specific negotiations are taking place in Copenhagen with a week to go in the conference. But with all the competing interests and the climate science fudging scandal distracting the press, a historic agreement may or may not be put in place that may or may not actually stop global warming and may or may not distribute the pain fairly. We are very happy to have with us now Dale Brick, director of the Air and Energy Program and a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC. Thanks very much for coming on, Dale. Hello.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
So I'm reading news websites from literally all over the world on this conference today, and the tone of recrimination is intense, especially from the developing world, where the basic message is the U.S. and Europe want us to remain locked in primitive poverty to stop global warming while they retain their opulent lifestyles. Is that a useful framework for the negotiations that are taking place?
I don't think that's a useful framework, but it's completely understandable why people are frustrated. These are very difficult issues. And just taking a step back to think about the context here, you've got 100 national leaders, almost 200 countries with a historic meeting. And what they're really trying to do is develop a pathway to move from the 19th century and in some cases even 18th century technologies that we've been using to power our economies and move towards 21st century new cleaner sources of energy, safer fuels. And that's a huge shift. That's a huge change in economies throughout the world that we're trying to orchestrate. So it makes perfect sense that there's going to be lots of complicated issues and tensions and emotions. And some of these countries, like you mentioned, Tuvalu, I mean, their life is at stake. You know, their whole livelihood is at stake. And we have some things in this country. You know, people in Alaska are losing their homes. They're collapsing into melting permafrost, but it's global warming is not something that's on the front minds of most people who are worried about the economy and national security issues. But all of these things are actually very, very tied together in the negotiations that we're seeing in Copenhagen.
And some of the psychology is interesting of this too, and the risk perception that goes with it. I'm sure you've seen the stats that say the opinion in the United States of whether global warming is real or not has taken a turn south since the recession hit. Fewer people believe that global warming is real, apparently as a result of their insecurities economically, though it's probably subconscious. The stats I read today say the U.S. and China together account for 40% of global warming emissions. And they are at odds, these two countries, in just this way of the developed and the developing worlds. China wants leeway to develop fast and keep most of the Copenhagen burden on the West. The U.S. wants to retain our lifestyle as much as possible and shift as much of the Copenhagen result to China. But President Obama and Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao both have pledged to attend the finale at Copenhagen next Friday. Does this indicate to you that they have a historic deal to announce?
there is going to be a historic deal. I mean, everything is not going to be completed at this meeting, and the framework that the delegates have set out for themselves is two steps, one agreement. And that's because, for reasons like in the United States, we haven't passed federal legislation yet. The House passed a bill in the summer to set up a new energy policy and address global warming for us. The Senate's in the process of negotiating. So we can't make every single commitment that we want to make over the long term in front of congressional action. But I do think that we're going to see an agreement out of Copenhagen that sets out the framework. I mean, there are huge, big issues that we can work out without putting, you know, every single detailed number. And you mentioned both the U.S. and China. Both countries have made serious commitments that they are going to reduce pollution and they are going to make that shift in their economies that I was discussing in the beginning about driving investment in new, cleaner technologies and really creating a long-term pathway to get to those long-term results that we need, where we need to see 80% reduction in pollution.
Well, the leadership of both countries, the U.S. and China, say they're committed to that. But you also just said that the details won't necessarily be there in whatever agreement is announced at Copenhagen. So will it be meaningful, or will it just be kind of an empty statement of principle that then they'll have to go and do the hard negotiations over in the future, and you know, and that's where it'll really matter?
Going to be meaningful, and we do need to develop sort of detailed agreements of exactly how we're going to do things. And you were talking about in the lead up to this discussion about, you know, what kind of assistance is going to come from developed countries to developing countries. Some of these countries are the most vulnerable in the world, and they don't have the resources to address the climate disruption that's already happening. And the United States has a huge interest, both on humanitarian grounds and also on this national security grounds, to make sure that every country has the resources, especially the developing countries, to develop in a smarter and cleaner way than we did.
So what's a developing country for these purposes? We heard the George Soros clip at the beginning where he said the disagreements between the developed and developing nations could actually wreck the conference. We have his proposal in the news today for using a certain kind of IMF reserve fund to fund the developing world, to help them buy the technology to advance without carbon. We have this new proposal from the EU that was on NPR News at the top of the hour, where EU leaders say they've agreed to commit the equivalent of $3.6 billion a year until 2012 to help poorer countries combat global warming. But does that mean the U.S. and Britain and France are going to be giving that money to China?
And it doesn't mean it's not just a transfer of wealth. It's not just cash payments to countries. And this is, I think, where the details that the delegates are negotiating are so important. In some cases, it's going to be direct financial assistance for dealing with adaptation, because you know if we're going to have more droughts, more floods, and more severe storms in places like Bangladesh, where they really can't address that could be huge refugee crisis. You can have armed conflict arising over scarce water resources. We already see that all over the world in places like Darfur and Somalia. So if we think of this as a national security investment, that's that I think makes people understand.
Well, that's
why
the argument,
interest
right?
Here.
But that's the argument for caring about it. When we look below that to $3.6 billion a year to help poorer countries combat global warming, Bangladesh isn't going to get the lion's share of that money. Maybe as a country that's particularly vulnerable, they'll get some of it for adaptation as well as prevention. But how much would you say of that $3.6 billion promised by the EU would go to China?
Yeah, I can't speculate to that number, and I think I don't think anybody can really put an accurate figure there, because that's exactly what the delegates are negotiating. And of course, the Tuvalus and the African countries and the Bangladeshis are all there saying we need this type of assistance more. And that was one of the controversies, where they felt they were being pressured to sign on to agreements where there was no detail about how the money was going to be distributed and what types of investments that was going to fund. And that's also a huge issue, which I think they are going to work out in Copenhagen, how to structure this so that you know that those investments are tied to performance and you're not worried that the money is going to just get squirreled away by some unscrupulous dictator, and you know that it's going to go to improving investments in better buildings, better, more efficient appliances and equipment for countries and those sorts of things that really will deliver results.
Dale Burke from NRDC, our guest, talking about the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference. And there's a lot of news out of Copenhagen today. Also, just a little while ago, I don't know if you heard this part yet, the president of France, Mr. Sarkozy, says the leaders agreed to reduce their emissions, that's the EU, by 30% compared to 1990 levels by the year 2020. In the past, EU leaders have pledged a 20% cut with an option to cut to 30% if other parts of the world will make the same kind of contribution. So are you in touch enough to know if that means other parts of the world have made the commitment to make that 30% carbon reduction contribution, and would that include the United States?
Yeah, part of the controversy underlying that decision by the EU was whether the United States was really stepping up and making a firm enough commitment. Obviously, at the federal level, we haven't done anything for 8 years, so this is new territory for us. There's been lots of activity at the state level and the local level in this country during that time. But again, we sort of have this tension where it's hard to make a specific commitment to a numerical reduction, percent of pollution reduction, when we're still negotiating this in Congress, but obviously there's been huge conversations between the White House and the congressional leaders on this issue before our delegation went to Copenhagen. So I think there's a lot of confidence that the United States is going to take very bold action. There's definitely a firm long-term commitment, and where the details that we don't have all the exact figures are in the near and medium-term commitments. But, we just heard earlier this week two things that I think probably gave a lot of confidence to the Europeans. One was Lisa Jackson at EPA saying, make no mistake, if the Congress doesn't act, EPA will act to address this issue. And you had President Obama coming out with a jobs initiative that was very tied to these issues, because one of the key components there was a program to drive investment in increasing the energy efficiency in people's homes and businesses. And if you just think of if we decided as a country that we're going to make every single house have better windows, better insulation, more efficient air conditioning and heating systems, how many people we would need to employ to undertake that. It's a huge jobs initiative, and all of those investments save money. You can reduce energy bills by 30% and more. New buildings could be 70% less energy using than what we've historically built. So that's why I was saying earlier that these issues are so closely tied together, to have the economic development plan in developed countries as well as in developing countries be tied towards investment in new cleaner technologies that just happen to be very, very job intensive compared to, if you think of a giant coal plant is basically a furnace burning dirty rocks that doesn't take very many people to operate. It's one of the least labor intensive investments we can make in our economy.
Well, let's hope so. But in your opinion, would Lisa Jackson, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, have the legal authority to mandate a 20% or 30% carbon emission reduction in the United States without going through Congress?
Well, she has the legal authority to regulate global warming pollution at specific facilities. So how far she could go down that road to get to what number, percentage-wise of the whole economy, I can't tell you off the top of my head, but we could definitely make a very large amount of progress. But that's not the best way. It's not the cheapest way. It's not the way that's going to drive investment in the cleanest technologies the quickest. And, I think she would be the first one to say she would much rather have a comprehensive energy policy adopted by Congress that could be designed in the smartest, cheapest way.
Yeah.
But she does have some tools that are very important to use with or without that legislation, because there's always going to be a role for EPA to be, setting up rules for, industries in different sectors to follow. And I think, she's going to do that. But I think we have better options on the table, and I think
and right now Congress is stuck over the cap and trade bill, which would cap total emissions but allow the marketplace to trade out which businesses do the polluting. There's a new bill being proposed in the Senate called the Clear Act which you know about, I'm sure, which takes a different approach from cap and trade. Susan Collins and other senators are behind this. And as I read it today on SeacoastOnline.com, for example, it targets the coal, natural gas, and oil companies that supply the power plants, requiring them to limit carbon production. The number of such suppliers is in the several thousand, as opposed to tens of thousands of producers like power plants nationwide. Also, the CLEAR Act mandates that the Department of Energy, not the stock market, oversee the auction of allowances. So do you think this is either politically more acceptable to Congress or better for the environment?
I don't think it's either one of those. I mean, there a carbon tax is very simple in concept, but look at our tax code, not very simple. A cap and trade program is very simple in the concept, but once you start negotiating real legislation and all the powerful political interests get involved, it gets messy. And, you know, this proposal is not that different as a cap and trade program. You're basically saying you're just putting the cap at a different place in the economy. It's more upstream.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get into the nitty-gritty details of actually negotiating, implementing this, you know, if this had political legs in Congress, it would get messy quickly. So I think the things that we want to keep in mind are the sort of the top line issue of having a mandatory pollution cap. So we know that pollution is going to go down. You can do that in lots of different ways. All the three ways that we just mentioned will deliver that result. And then you want to make sure that you're driving investment in clean energy technologies. You can do that with additional policies, like having a standard that says every utility has to invest in a certain amount of energy efficiency, has to invest in a certain amount of renewable energy, or you can sort of embed that in your design of your overall program. But all of these things can deliver the same environmental result. Then you have just the political situation. I mean, the bill that we have that the House passed and that's going through the Senate now, that's something we can pass this year. And from my perspective, the most important thing for us to do is to get the sort of regulatory infrastructure in place, send the signal to business that this is going to be the new environment that you're going to operate in. And businesses are clamoring for this. They need to know what the rules are so that they can make their investments in the smartest way. And if we don't do this year, because we start thinking about a completely new way of doing something that has not been negotiated in Congress, then it could be next year or the year after before we really step up and say we are, you know, absolutely doing this. And that's going to cause a huge problem both for the economy and for the environment.
We have a few minutes left with environmental lawyer Dale Brick, director of the Air and Energy Program at the environmental group Natural Resources Defense Council. Stephen in Homedale, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had heard you earlier mention that the polls say that the public is turning away from the validity of global warming, probably because of the recession and thinking about their pocketbook, how much it'll cost. But I thought it was very interesting. I was watching the NBC Nightly News last week, and on the eve of the Copenhagen conference, they did a three-minute piece on the email controversy, and it was substantial, solid
mm-hmm.
2.5-3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And after talking about there was a controversy and there was these emails and there's deniers of global warming, they never discussed what was in the emails, what the controversy was, or whether it was valid. And I kind of shook my head saying, if this is what the average person, the public, hears, again, they reported the controversy, no issues were delved into, I'm not surprised that the public turns away, because the message was so effective, the smokescreen, to try to take away from the message of Copenhagen, that they succeeded in my mind. Like, most people know the controversy, but they don't know that one email that was supposed to be a smoking gun, one of the scientists said, oh, it would be great if their stuff wasn't published in peer review papers. Well, what they were discussing, which is not nice, was all published anyway. So there is no controversy. That's like one of the most three important points. So I'm just amazed how effective that message was. And I think it succeeded with the American public.
Thank you.
And I'm very disappointed in that, because the acid rain controversy was successful in the late 80s, and it's a similar issue. And I don't, maybe your guests can comment, mm-hmm. what could be analogous from that controversy, which was successful and wound up costing less money than they said, and everyone benefits from it.
Right, you mean the acid rain, the anti-acid rain agreement from the 1980s, which was successful. Well, Dale Burke, do you want to comment at all? I was going to bring it up anyway, on the email scandal. It does look like there was some actual fudging that took place. It does look like there certainly was not a commitment on those few scientists involved to the transparency of scientific data. That's certainly a very bad thing. But my understanding is the data involved were about relatively minor points around the edges and certainly don't refute the consensus of 95% of environmental sciences that the basic thrust of global warming as we understand it is real.
Right, right. That's absolutely right. And your caller makes some excellent, excellent points. So, yes, we're talking about a handful of emails compared to, you know, thousands of scientists over decades of research. There's just no comparison. There's absolutely no dent in the overall conclusion and the consensus that's ongoing that global warming is real, that it's happening now. And not only that, but that it presents a clear and present danger to the United States. That's the finding of the Pentagon. That's not, you know, some left-wing environmental group out in la-la land. I mean, we're talking about the National Academy of Science of this country and many other countries and the CIA and the Pentagon and, as I said, thousands of scientists. So there's just really, there is no issue on the science side, but the media arm of big oil and big coal is very powerful and very clever, and as your guest pointed out, you know, it's really disappointing, but this has run with the media. But I think, you know, you put it in perspective correctly. There's a couple of little issues there, and nobody wants scientific integrity more than we do.
Well,
we're usually committed to that, and there'll be an investigation, but it's not really relevant to the overarching issue and the conclusions that are quite solid.
There are some data issues there, but I think that they're not, you know, as you say, relevant to the overarching is it or isn't it real question. We're going to dig into those issues more in a segment next week, and we're going to dig more into the uncertainties surrounding global warming, because while there's a huge scientific consensus about the fundamental reality of it, I think there's also tremendous uncertainty about how severe the impact would be in different places if we continue at our present rates or only slightly reduced rates.
Right.
So we will get into, but how much, this is your last question, how much are you willing to acknowledge as an environmental group attorney that there is a lot of uncertainty in the data as to, maybe we know the Maldives will be underwater, which is in and of itself a terrible, terrible thing looking forward a few decades. But how much do we really know about the impact to places like New York and and many other places in the world?
Right. There is huge uncertainty, and that's actually a reason to act, not a reason not to act. I mean, I don't know if my house is going to burn down. I have fire insurance. I don't know if I'm going to get sick. I have health insurance. You know, we know that someone's going to get sick, and we know that someone's house is going to burn down, and it's very similar with global warming. We know that these things are going to happen if we don't take action, and we need to take both sort of insurance action and proactive action to prevent things. And yes, there's, you know, there's mixed feelings among the American public, and people are focused on things like the economy and national security, but all Americans want to take control of the energy future. All of them want to be in the lead of the clean energy technology revolution that we're going to have in this world. And, you know, we can buy our next generation technologies from the Chinese and the Danes and the Germans, or we can build them ourselves. And, you know, this is sort of a country that we take pride in the notion that we know how to build better mousetraps, and we're the country of innovation. And historically, we've proven that to be the case, and I think we're going to prove it again.
Dale Burke, Director of the Air and Energy Program, Senior Attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, the defeated Nassau County Executive, Tom Suozzi, next.